This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. The best bits of today's show. It is a Friday, the longest day of the year, 21st of June. Will it be the longest Bite-Sized Business Breakfast of the year? Well, no. But it is a corker today because we've got reaction to big stories coming out of Europe yesterday. Not one, not two, but three central banks deciding on interest rates. Norway and Britain deciding to stick. The Swiss being more bold, deciding to cut interest rates for the second time this year. We'll get details and reaction to that. What else have I got for you? Tom Harvey of Spinneys. They are opening in Saudi Arabia. He joined us in the studio to explain why. We've been talking Summonomics with the boss of the Coca-Cola Arena, Mark Yankar. Great interview between him and Brandy. On the upside, he's got a giant air-conditioned indoor arena, perfect for summer. On the downside, not many people are here, so he can't sell many tickets. Conversation with Mark coming up, and then Henk Potts of Barclays Private Bank in London. Spoke to him Thursday afternoon, just after that Bank of England decision, looking at the decision and also what you should be doing with your money when it comes to investing in Europe. So much political upheaval at the moment. European elections, French elections, British elections. I could go on. Where should you put your savings? All that to come. First up, though, let's jump straight into those top stories.
Oh, well, we are continuing with our Summonomics.
When I met you in the summer, to my heartbeat sound, we fell in love as the leaves turn brown.
Yeah, we are indeed looking at the business of summer. We've been speaking to Tom Harvey, General Manager of the Commercial Business at Spinneys, asking him how the hotter months affect their sales.
Well, typically for us, summer is a quieter period anyway. We tend to see a lot of customers leaving for the whole of the summer. So what we tend to see is a little bit of a change in some of the consumption habits. We get a lot of families suddenly become single-person households. A lot more, actually, of the increase in some of the prepared products where people are just thinking, it's so much easier to grab a quick fresh salad from Spinneys than have to go home and do it just for myself.
Quick update on the Spinneys share price falling yesterday, down another 1.5%. Yeah, buy a salad from Spinneys if you want. You can buy shares in Spinneys now, of course.
You're not allowed to tell people to buy a salad from Spinneys?
No.
Because you own some shares, do you not?
I do.
There will be no salad recommendations from Richard Dean.
Yes, exactly.
Other supermarkets are available.
But I don't know if the salads are on sale, but the shares are. Spinneys IPO price was above 1.50 dirham. Yesterday closed at 1.38, 1.39. I'm not tipping the stock, but it is cheaper than the IPO price, and the IPO was massively oversubscribed.
Not the only stock at the moment that is cheaper than the IPO's price, though. Am I right?
Yeah, Diwa's well below the IPO price at the moment. Again, I didn't check yesterday, but Diwa's share is about 228, I think it was, just before Eid al-Fitr. Diwa's share price. What did you pay in the IPO? Because you actually bought into the IPO.
Yeah, I'm not allowed to tell you to turn the lights on.
Exactly. I think you paid...
Keep your AC off.
250-something. But yesterday, shares of Diwa closed at 2 dirhams and 24 fils. Diwa IPO price was 2 dirhams 48. So it's about 10% below its IPO price. Now, many stocks are well above their IPO price, of course, but, you know, that's the nature of markets, isn't it? But you can still buy... And another one that's below its IPO price is... the Investcorp one in Abu Dhabi, the Bahraini company listed in Abu Dhabi late last year, early this year. That's, you know, quite far below its IPO price. Many of them are well above it. A lot of the Abu Dhabi, the ADNOC ones, doing really well. They're well above their IPO price, lots of them.
Yeah, people buying in, of course, for a long-term hold for a lot of these stocks, and there's the dividend policies to look at and think about as well if you are looking at the local stock markets. Right, so summer this morning, we're looking at the events industry. We're going to speak to the big boss of the Coca-Cola Arena. They are an indoor venue. They are air-conditioned. But do they have the crowds? Are there enough people in town to get in? Tom's got a bit of a theory that a lot of people have disappeared on Eid and stayed away. Does it still hold, or are you changing your thesis?
I'm not changing my thesis. I'm ready to be proven otherwise on Monday, because the one disclaimer would be people coming. But, you know, if you're off until, we had Monday, Tuesday off this week because of Eid. So you tag on the rest of the week and then you come back at the weekend. We were told that the 22nd was going to be D-Day at the airport, weren't we?
When the busiest.
Everyone invaded the beaches. So when's the 22nd?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Okay, so yeah, so tomorrow. But is that people coming back or is that people leaving? That's what we didn't hear. We just heard it was going to be footfall at the airport. So could be either, couldn't it? Because either it's people coming back from that extended e-break or it's people going, I don't want to pay double airfares 7 days later, so I'm doing one a weekend early.
Well, we are speaking to a lot of people to try and get a measure of whether Tom is right or not.
I'm always right.
Who does agree with him? One person.
Oh, is?
Eugene Kerrigan.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Eugene, you spoke to Eugene yesterday, didn't you?
I did indeed. He is the boss of a summer camp, a science summer camp called the Curiosity Lab. We wanted to know what his bookings look like for the summer and whether or not they backed up Tom's theory of people doing one.
I agree with Tom's theory. So we're actually working with a school next week. We're doing a field trip where we go into the school. And across the year group, it's 275 students. And we do it kind of by head. And they are concerned that they're not going to reach 200 students, which across 1 year group in one school is a significant percentage of kids that they're not convinced will be returning after Eid. It's a big percentage. Now, that's their worst case scenario. But it's gone from 275 that they're reasonable. And be confident that it's going to come in at over 200. But that's a big chunk of kids that have not returned post-Eid.
Quarter of families gone? No.
I think it's... Look, it's difficult, isn't it? I've got two kids still at school, and therefore I don't want to be the one that says that parents are irresponsible in taking kids out of school. But especially when the flight prices are so high this summer, you are looking at bottom lines and you are looking at what it costs to get back to wherever you go into the summer and things like that. It's not everyone, and I know that it's just the privileged few that they are able to get away for extended periods of the summer. But as Tom Harvey's just been saying, they see a drop down there. The schools, we're seeing that drop. Roads. How much more evidence do you want me to put in front of you guys? You know, why do you just not believe me, you two?
The thing is that those flights have got to be significantly cheaper if it's going to be worth missing 2 weeks of work.
Have you ever sat down and figured out how much you're paying per day to have your kids in school?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And?
Let's not talk about it.
Because that's what you're offsetting, isn't it?
Yeah. And that was the point I was going to make. If you think about how much you're paying in school fees or how much you're earning, you know, the opportunity cost of leaving early. Okay, you may save a bit on flights, but that bit has got to be quite a lot. If you're working, but even if you've got kids in school.
Like Tom was saying a minute ago, I think it's not the whole of the family going away. It's one of the breadwinners of the family. It's either the mother or the father taking kids away, and that's again, you know, that's just with kids and families. But I'm seeing a big trend this year of people working remotely away as well. So they're going, you know what, I'm done one for the summer, won't be back until September. I'm still working, but I'm working remotely because you can.
Yeah, right, let's put in the application, see if we can get away with it.
That's what Zoom's there for, isn't it? Or Teams.
We shall largely be zooming in on the Business Breakfast from a beach this summer.
This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We've got Tom Harvey, the Commercial General Manager of Spinneys, sitting in front of me in the studio this morning. But over the weekend, he will be making his way to Saudi Arabia. Very big week for Spinneys. They are opening up their first ever store in the kingdom. Tom, good morning. Thanks for joining us. In the quickest turnaround and the quickest trip into the Business Breakfast studio, I think, in your broadcasting history.
It is, yeah. Hester Street is very clear this morning, so no need for any other traffic reports. It's nice and easy out there.
There you go. He's done it for you. Right, you're opening up in Riyadh on Monday morning. What exactly are you opening?
Yeah, so we've got our first store in Saudi Arabia. We are very excited. So this is in Riyadh. This has been a little while in the making. We have a joint venture with Al Hakair over in Saudi Arabia. So this is a store opening a new mall called La Strada. We've been very careful in terms of selecting locations to make sure that it is very much fitting with the typical Spinneys audience, and we've identified quite a few sites that we will be opening over the coming years. But quite a big store by our standards, so nearly 40,000 square feet. Slightly different to what we do here, because obviously in the UAE we have a lot of our own factories. We manufacture a lot of our products in our factories here in Dubai, and we will be having to do a little bit more of the manufacturing on site in Riyadh to make sure that we can continue to give the right levels of freshness.
Okay, let's break that down. When we say 40,000 square feet, give us a Spinneys store here in Dubai that would be close to.
So our stores vary here between about 3,000 square feet and 40,000 square feet. So and typically we're around the 25,000. So in terms of size, it's a little bit like sort of the Spinneys Motor City or Waitrose Nakheel Mall, Waitrose Dubai Mall. Those are the sort of the larger stores. It'll be about that size.
And why are you having to manufacture in Saudi? Is there a big difference between that and bringing stuff over from Dubai?
There's different regulations for Saudi, so a lot of things have to be approved by the SFDA, the Saudi Food and Drug Administration. And so some of the things that we're doing here, we need to get approvals. That can take some time. So in the meantime, we're going to be manufacturing everything in-house, on-site, in the store, to make sure we're giving the right levels of freshness and quality.
How many jobs are you creating there?
Well, over time, it will be quite a lot. So, I mean, we're intending to open in the region of 20 stores between now and 2028. They will be focused on two cities, Riyadh and Jeddah. So Riyadh is where we're opening first. But we do expect to create, we have typically sort of in a store that size, 170, 200 staff per store. So there should be some very significant opportunities for job creation.
How much food can you actually source locally in Saudi when it comes to the fresh stuff? I mean, we get Sky Kurtz's tomatoes off you here in the UAE. So is there an equivalent in Saudi?
Yeah, there is. I mean, Sky's got its own farms in Saudi as well. So we have been talking with them. Look, Saudi's got some fantastic produce. It's obviously a very big country, slightly more diverse in terms of terrain. You go up towards the Red Sea, there is a lot of farming going on across Saudi. So we can buy quite a bit locally. The important thing for us is actually also what we're making with it. So it's all about making sure that we're delivering that fresher experience, the broad range of fresh food that we offer here. As you know, in the UAE, 62% of everything that we sell is fresh food, out of 85% of all of our sales coming from food. And so it'll be a lot of taking those ingredients and then adding value in the way that Spinneys does. So making all those beautiful salads, all of the prepared roast chickens and the beautiful cuts of meat and the preparations we do with those that will be where we make a difference.
Okay, so Spinneys has really ramped up its offerings in the last year or so in terms of the different things that you do. One of the most recent we've seen is what I think of as the Spinneys Food Hall that you have opened up in Dubai Mall. Any chance we could bring that to Saudi Arabia?
Well, we're going to start with the supermarkets, first of all, because we think what we do with our Spinneys offer is certainly quite different to what the market's got already. Typically, supermarkets in the region are operating with less than half of their sales coming from fresh food. So we think bringing the Spinneys offer as a supermarket, first of all, is going to be quite disruptive to what consumers are looking for. And then we'll see what happens in terms of how we expand out that fresh food offer. So I can't say that we've got any plans on the kitchen by Spinneys yet, but the fresher experience that we offer in all of our stores is certainly something that we're looking forward to bringing to consumers in Saudi.
What about the Zest Pharmacy joint venture?
So the Zest Pharmacy joint venture is a joint venture in the UAE. So we'll be focused on keeping that in the UAE for the moment. But again, we've got a lot of learnings for what we do. A lot of the products that we offer in there, we're still able to offer in our new stores in Saudi. We will be developing what we do with a really exciting range of health and well-being products that will go into the stores.
Could have any chance with potential pharmacy partners in Saudi Arabia?
I'm not aware of anything we're doing on that at the moment, so I don't think we can say anything on that right now.
What's the biggest challenge, or what has been the biggest challenge so far in getting things set up to open on Monday in Saudi?
Well, obviously, it's a different country. There are different regulations. There's different registration processes, and there have been some different requirements in terms of things as simple as some of the nutritional information that's required on packs. So we've had to make quite a few changes to some of the products to make sure we comply with that. Every country has different challenges. Saudi's been a really interesting market to learn how to operate, and we are very, very excited about the opportunity going forwards.
And of course, Saudi has, is it the Nikitet system that's the Saudiization hiring policies?
Yes, it does. So we have got different regulations. It's obviously an Emiratization program here. There's a Saudiization program in Saudi. So that does put restrictions on certain jobs can only be done by Saudi nationals. And they are then supported by some of the team that we've flown over from here to get things kicked off. But we do expect that to be something where we are employing a lot of Saudis in the stores in future.
How far could this go across the Gulf? How much further could you take Spinneys?
Well, we will start with Saudi. So we have said, you know, we will continue to explore options for other countries in the GCC, and actually further beyond is something we continue to look at in terms of what we can do with Spinneys. Saudi is a big opportunity for us. So we see a significant amount of white space, even by just launching only into Riyadh and Jeddah. A lot of our target market is based in those two cities. So it's taking a lot of time. A lot of the team is over in Saudi at the moment, and we'll be working all weekend to make sure that we are ready for Monday morning. So we'll focus on Saudi, and we'll see what happens in the future. I'll come back and talk about that at another time.
1 minute left with you. If you want to weigh into our Summernomics feature, what do you see sales of spike in the hotter months here? What goes up?
Well, typically for us, summer is a quieter period anyway. We tend to see a lot of customers leaving for the whole of the summer. So what we tend to see is a little bit of a change in some of the consumption habits. We get a lot of families suddenly become single person households. I'm a classic version of that. So I guess we see a lot more actually of the increase in some of the prepared products, where people are just thinking, it's so much easier to grab a quick fresh salad from Spinneys than have to go home and do it just for myself.
Less actual cooking is what you're saying,
little
Tom.
Bit, yeah.
Rise of Magnums and ice creams, or are we eating those all year round?
Eating those all year round. Actually, we see more of that when we get into the winter, because people are outdoors and enjoying the beautiful winters we have here.
Tom Harvey, General Manager of the commercial business at Spinneys. They're opening their first ever Saudi Arabia shop on Monday morning. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Where we are talking Summernomics here on the Business Breakfast, having a look at what the hotter months mean economically around town. Tonight at the Coca-Cola Arena, they mean this guy. That is going to be the sounds coming out of downtown tonight. Coca-Cola Arena have got a lovely double bill. They've got Hussein Al-Jazmi, they've got Tamer Asour, and we have got in the studio Mark Ian Carr, the man who's putting it all together. Mark, it's lovely to see you again. Good morning.
Good morning.
Right, we were wondering, is it good for you or bad for you? On the plus side, you are a lovely, cool, air-conditioned indoor venue. On the downside, you still have to fill it with people.
True. So the reality is, if we compare the beautiful weather about Dubai, our competitive advantage really sort of kicks in sort of March through to end of June, first few days of July in terms of activities. So there is a demand. There is still shows coming through. You have certain genres, in particular the Western, that certainly drops off in terms of attendance. But if you have a look at a sort of our activity, it's more sort of the cultural content that's coming through, and or Arabic and Southeast Asian, which still exceptionally strong. We had Amir Diab in on Tuesday night, and over 9,000 people in the building.
What would be normal crowd is how long of a piece of string, but what kind of differences do you see in the audiences over summer?
You probably see differences in terms of the genres that we obviously, we've taken a few years to really understand that Dubai market. Of course, you know, it's expatriates, the traditional thought process is expatriates sort of leave for the summer, or sort of families leave over the summer. Whereas you've got demographics like the Southeast Asian, perhaps they don't necessarily all go all go as long back to European countries, if that's the case. So we certainly see the content mix that we're looking at programming over the summer, but we also see spending habits change. You obviously find that ticket price, what we aim to have the tickets prices probably at least 20 to 30% cheaper over the summer to be able to attract the demographic coming through, and in the sense of, you know what, I've got summer holidays planning, I'm planning for school fees coming through or rent due or something along those lines. That's an affordable ticket. Let's still have a good night out.
Do you have any visibility into what you see in terms of people coming in from other Gulf states for these concerts?
We do. Obviously, we track two forms of sort of insights that we collate. At the ticket point of purchase, we obviously have our own ticketing platform and we work with great partners like PlatinumList and Ticketmaster. So at the point of purchasing a ticket, it asks for your nationality and your residence. And then obviously during the actual physical events, we do insights. So we've got a team on the ground, probably two out of every four events we're on the ground. And we obviously can't get everyone, but we get a very decent sample pool. And we're asking information about how did you arrive to the venue? When did you purchase a ticket? How did you hear about the show? As well as then asking them the nationality, are they residents, which emirate they come from, and so forth.
Right. So do we see a lot of golf visitors coming in who might be a little bit bored elsewhere?
Not necessarily.
Saudi a competition for you now that they're doing more over the summer months? Giant billboard down the road of people picnicking in what looks like relative cool, telling me that Saudi's great for summer.
So Saudi, I would say in the back end of 22 and 23 was certainly a competition, but specifically in the Western content space. We still see the same Arabic artists performing in Dubai as well as perhaps in Abu Dhabi. And Southeast Asian artists are not performing at the level of, for example, Dubai and Saudi. So it's very specific AAA content that is heading over to Saudi. But certainly now we're working closer with the different organization bodies and you'll start to see more Western content that are perhaps performing at Saudi after the F1 or the Formula E or a festival that they're then performing in Dubai.
I was going to say, how much can you share acts? I mean, where I come from, New Zealand, a lot of people who would be coming through to play in Australia will also go on to New Zealand, mm-hmm. and there's a bit of a cost-sharing thing going on between the two destinations. Are we doing that?
Again, for the first, especially Saudi's a massive acceleration, the first few years they were working on exclusivity clauses in the sense that that performance was the only one in the region. They have since realized that the economics of that doesn't work, allowing sort of countries like the UAE and Qatar to work with the teams in Saudi and or their artist management. So we're certainly seeing a shift of more sharing in the Western space necessarily than it was previously.
Okay, so coming out of summer and coming into the quarter that technically Q4, but I think we think of it as Q1 because it's when Dubai restarts. We've got some rebookings of some cancellations that we had earlier. What does the lineup look like for you?
So again, it's an interesting city that we live in Dubai in the sense that it's still the notion of fairly last minute. So if you look at, for example, New Zealand or in Europe, venues are announcing shows 12 to 18 months ahead. We are getting better in that. If I was here in the studio a couple of years ago, we were announcing shows 2 or 3 weeks in advance. We're now announcing shows 4 or 5 months in advance, but not all of them, of course. Those particular ones are on world tours. But to answer your question, we've got an incredible lineup. Every venue will say that, but we genuinely do. Starting, you know, at the end of August, that will restart the season. We've got Enrique Iglesias on the 13th of September. It's a one show only. That show is officially sold out. It's sold out in 5 days, which was unbelievable. There is not a second show. So for those that are people are waiting, unfortunately, there isn't. We've obviously got, you know, 30 Seconds to Mars coming through. We've got incredible bands like CAS, Leah Sonlaga. And, you know, so really, really strong content, both in Western, Southeast Asian, Arabic and Russian speaking.
The last time we spoke to you, we were speaking about the cost of getting acts, and not just acts, but also all of the staging and the costumes and everything around them. Supply chain issues have been a big thing for every industry. Are those bottlenecks starting to ease out for you?
They are. The artist costs have consistently risen. And one thing we have to take in consideration is when we're talking about a specific artist, that's perhaps the artist that is performing on stage. But when they're performing in an arena, they have a full entourage. They have dancers, they have a band, they have engineers, they've got crew coming through. As an example, the Enrique, there's 88 traveling. So when you're talking about sort of an artist fee, you consistently think, oh, that's how much he's making. But obviously there is 88 that actually physically travel for that performance. And then you've probably got at least another 20 or 30 back of house. So artist fees consistently increase, as do sort of airlines and lodging and cost of living, I guess. Where we've seen sort of the ease of bottlenecks in terms of production and air freight, that has certainly sort of eased the costings. There's a greater supply in the market. They've made big investments in, you know, items and inventories now kept in both the UAE and Saudi, allowing us to sort of be a little bit more competitive. But, you know, the number one for us is to ensure that even though costs of artist fees are going up, ticket prices remain consistent.
1 minute left with you. Richard is disappearing off to London to see the Swift a little bit later on. We were debating the other day, what would it actually take to get her to Dubai? Is the deciding factor a bigger venue? Is it a size of population issue? What's stopping us from being a Swift hub?
I think it's the priority for the artist. It obviously respects all countries and opportunities, but the reality is when she's performing, you know, 9 or 10 shows in London, and there's probably a waiting list around the world, where does Dubai fit in? We obviously have a, you know, a population of 9 to 10 million, and you could easily do 3 or 4 shows of 20 or 30,000, but she's performing in Wembley to, you know, 80 to 100,000. She's doing, you know, nearly 1 million people through the doors. So the economics of that don't necessarily stack up to do a one-time show in Dubai. Of course, there is conversations completely above my pay level. It won't be at the Coca-Cola Arena. It has to be outdoors. But we keep our fingers crossed.
Mark Yankar speaking to us this morning, the boss of the Coca-Cola Arena. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's get more on those interest rate decisions in Europe now. From Henk Potts, who is market strategist at Barclays Private Wealth in London, regular visitor to Dubai. We often speak to him. But yesterday, I spoke to him on Zoom from London. So we wanted to talk about the Bank of England rate decision on hold at 5.25%, contrasting that with other central banks. ECB last week, cutting rates. Swiss National Bank yesterday morning, cutting rates. So we asked Henk, first of all, did the Bank of England get it right in keeping rates so high?
Listen, I think it was a close call from the Bank of England this time around. Obviously, we had the May inflation report, and they would have seen that. That showed, of course, the fact that CPI decelerated to the 2% target level for the first time since July 2021 in May. Remember, that was down from that 2.3% that was registered in April. So there was some pressure, I think, on the Bank of England this time around, but it wasn't enough to persuade them to cut rates, as you quite rightly said. They kept rates on hold at that 16-year high at 5.25%. Listen, I think the MPC were cognizant of April's higher than expected consumer price index print. They need to observe general election protocols as well. There's all sorts of issues around cutting rates during a campaigning period. Perhaps they would be focusing on a little bit there. But as we saw, 7 members voted to keep rates on hold. 2 went for a cut. But most importantly, they did say the decision was finally balanced. The Bank of England raised its growth forecast for the second quarter as well. The markets, of course, reacted to that. Sterling was a little bit weaker. 2-year bond yields coming under pressure as well. So listen, I think this was expected, but I think it does indeed leave the door open for a rate cut in the future.
As an outsider looking in at the UK economy, I mean, it looks to me like a classic scenario that they should be cutting rates. And I listen to people like Andy Haldane, former chief economist at the Bank of England. He's been crying out for the bank to cut rates since the start of the year. British economy in recession, only just out of it now. Inflation back to 2%. My basic first year undergraduate economics would say that's when you cut interest rates. Does the UK economy not need a bit of a shot in the arm at the moment?
I think it does. They're probably being a little bit cautious. I suppose the question is, where do we go from here? Given the fact, as you say, we have seen that progress on inflation, given the fact that labour market conditions have been easing. Remember, UK unemployment rose to 4.4% in April. That's the highest that we've seen since September 2021. That'll take some of that pressure off wage growth that they've been concerned about. And as you quite rightly pointed out, the European Central Bank has cut interest rates as well. I think that will leave the door open for a rate reduction at the August meeting. And markets, I think, have been reacting to that. We've seen them move even further today, now pricing in more than a 50% chance of a 25 basis point reduction coming through. So listen, they didn't cut rates this time around. UK economy, I think, will continue to underperform over the course of this year. The Bank of England will react to that. We will see rate cuts coming through at August. And then beyond that, I think we'll see further reductions coming through. So we actually expect a 25 basis point reduction coming through in the November meeting, but also the December meeting as well. And then further rate cuts coming through in 2025. Actually, by the time that we get to August next year, we've got UK rates down at 3.75%.
And as investors here in the Middle East, looking at European markets, a lot of the headlines are about turmoil at the moment over the past 10 days or so since the European elections. And one story we picked up on this morning was an Italian sneaker company called Golden Goose pulled its IPO in Milan this week, citing the fallout from the European elections. Now, one Italian sneaker company isn't going to move the markets, but how concerned should we be about European markets? Or perhaps is this sell-off a buying opportunity?
Well, listen, I think there is obviously some concern around how those elections will play out in France, and that's been unnerving markets. But you should also remember it's against the backdrop of the strong performance that we've seen from equity markets as well. And we think there's probably limited upside for equity markets, certainly at an index level, although individual stocks we still see some opportunities for. So in terms of how investors should be positioned, I think the fact that we've got slowing growth, we've got disinflation, still got elevated interest rates, although they are expected to fall as we go through the course of this year. The real focus investors should be thinking about, I think, is really on quality companies. And for us, what does that mean? Well, that means companies that have got solid balance sheets, low financial leverage, stable earnings through the business cycle. And I think that's going to be incredibly important. So we continue to look at defensive sectors. That means utilities, consumer staples, global energy stocks, I think, still look very attractive. We know they've been trading at a discount. The dividend still looks very attractive. They are, of course, a hedge against geopolitical tensions, rising oil prices as well. So I think you've got to be well positioned and be thinking about where you've got exposure to when it comes to market, as you take into account the geopolitical tensions that are playing out, but also the fact that we have seen a strong performance from equity markets, and you've got those macroeconomic tensions in there as well.
The thoughts of Henk Potts, market strategist at Barclays Private Bank, speaking to me yesterday afternoon from London.
Yeah, Switzerland making that second interest rate cut. The question, what happens with arbitrage opportunities if we start seeing central banks continue to diverge?
Yeah, and I know one of the things that we're going to look at as part of our Summonomics series, I think, Tom, it was you mentioned it yesterday, was, or might have been you, Brandy, one of the things we should look at is holiday currencies. Where is it a good time to visit at the moment? And interest rates are playing into that. For example, you've got the Japanese yen at the moment. Japanese central bank keeping interest rates stubbornly low, close to zero. United States above 5%. The dollar yen's around about 160 at the moment. And I was listening to one currency strategist on Bloomberg saying for an American earning dollars, and we earn dollars here, the place to go this summer is Japan. 160 yen against the dollar. Now go to Tokyo. Go to Osaka at the moment. Euro's also good value if you're spending dollars because the euro's weak, but the biggie is the dollar. Was it you, Tom, who mentioned we should look at currencies?
Yeah, that in terms of value, and B, just...
weather compared to Southern Europe at the moment.
And the weather.
And?
No, I was going to say just in terms of currencies, whether there's any point we were talking about traditions yesterday when we were at the airport, and I still change currency at the airport, and I don't know why, because most of the world is going cashless at the moment, so most people are using their cards left, right and centre, so what is the point of currency conversion, etc. at the moment? Do you remember like going on holiday, you used to order currency from your bank and it used to get delivered to you in a little envelope?
Traveller's checks.
I had traveller's checks. I'm older than you and I did.
Yeah.
My parents would get traveller's checks from the bank. You'd have to go and pick them up. They'd print them for you. Do you use the folding? Do you get through it that you take with you, or do you end up changing it back, or more likely sticking it in a drawer?
I don't spend, it's like, so I've just come back from the UK, and it's very difficult to use cash in the UK at the moment. But the smiles you put on faces when you tip people in cash in the UK is worth it. And that's what I use it for.
That's when I was in India a couple of weeks ago, I got cash predominantly for tipping.
Yeah.
That was pretty much all I used it for.
And it just comes as a massive surprise to people, you know.
Particularly like, when the cash machine's only given you a 50 quid note.
Well, you know, I'm just that kind of guy.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.